It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After 22 years of leadership at the Rape Victim Advocacy Program in Iowa City, Carla Miller has retired from her position as RVAP's director. She started as a volunteer at the organization in 1977, became a coordinator from 81 to 91. Between 91 and 2002, she went back to school and worked for Iowa's Civil Commitment Unit for Sexual Offenders. Then in 2002, she took over as director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program in Iowa City, and we've invited her into our studio today to reflect on her decades of work in this area. Carla Miller, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Remind us of why this organization, Rape Victim Advocacy Program, was started and the work that it does.
Yeah, it started around the beginning of the 70s, the reemergence of the feminist movement and kind of looking at the issues that were barriers to women and, you know, everything from economic barriers to child care, health care, all of those things. And, of course, among those were violence, domestic violence and sexual violence. And so there were a group of women called, with the acronym of WAR, Women Against Rape. And it was, you know, these conversations were going on all across the country. And it was recognized that there was a need for people to support victims and to tell them what to expect if they reported, and also to be advocates for them when they ran into these barriers.
Mm-hmm. Because for a woman facing, for instance, sexual violence or domestic violence, prior to this awareness raising or this, a woman would just not know?
Wouldn't know, but also was often met with, you know, consistently, victims were met with major hostility and disbelief. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of training about how to handle these cases. And also, I think that you really saw kind of the height of the impact of myths around sexual assault that really just served the perpetrators, but that it was easy to cry rape and hard to disprove, and that's kind of a very quick, short paraphrase of a justice who made that statement.
That probably a lot of blame that the victims faced. Why did you wear that, or why did you behave in that way?
Or what? Why did you drink? Why did you know? What were you doing? How did you? And you know, as you think about our culture and how girls are raised and how boys are raised, a lot of the sexual stereotyping involved kind of putting the ideas into girls' heads that if they didn't behave in a proper way or in a prescribed way, that bad things would happen to them and it would be their fault. Now, you know, if you compare, sadly today, there's still a lot of victim blaming, but there's also pushback and there's also people who are willing to critically think about how they have internalized those beliefs. And so, you know, in that way, in that respect, it still exists. That's really unfortunate. And it's it kind of highlights that it's not an educational issue, or after all these years, you know, we'd be much further ahead.
I wonder, when we think back to the 1970s, and you were there almost from the beginning at the Rape Victim Advocacy Program, when this new program was initiated, was there pushback? Were the people just saying, we don't need this program? What is this for? Whereas today, it's so much a part of the Iowa City Cedar Rapids community that we don't doubt its need, the need for it, I guess I should say. But then I have to imagine, as a new force in male-female relationships, it had to be questioned.
Oh, my goodness. It was there was major pushback from every arena. You know, law enforcement didn't want us there. They saw us as interfering. They saw us as radical, unprofessional, outrageous women. And we got pushback from the medical community. And one of the stories that I have really liked to tell over the years is when Sheriff Robert Carpenter, who was the sheriff here for decades
in Johnson County.
Mm-hmm. He told a story on a panel that we were on together about a few years later about how he used to race to get to the victim and start the interview before the advocate got there. So he'd get his work done. And then he went on to say that after working with advocates, he realized he wouldn't start an interview without the advocate being present. And I thought, wow, there's no higher praise than that. But it also was an indicator that there had been movement and understanding that, you know, there were some very practical things about it. For example, if the advocate was there to meet the needs of victims, the police could go ahead and after their job was done, they could go do the other work they needed to do. And also that, you know, caring people want to know that somebody is taking care of the emotional needs of somebody that they've just interacted with. And so I think that that was hard-earned. We really had to become professional very, very quickly and become very, very knowledgeable in all of the different first responder positions. What do they do? For example, law enforcement and nurses
and I imagine the organization, the people working in, had to adjust too. It was not as if only one side had a learning curve.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It was a hard adjustment, and some were easier. And what it really depended on, as anything does, is one-on-one personal relationships that were developed. That, for example, with Dr. DeProse at the university, worked with residents to train them on how to work with sexual abuse survivors and how to do the exams so that there would be consistency. We had, you know, a nurse, Linda Whitaker, who moved that along. And we certainly had lots of individuals, police officers. And I remember Barry Bedford, the chief of Coralville Police, and I worked many cases together with another investigator, and he was very good and open to learning about working with survivors. And they were able to talk to their colleagues and kind of vouch for us, just as we were able to vouch for police, certain police officers. And I think that's the beginning of when we started really collaborating.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Carla Miller, the recently retired director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program in Iowa City. Been in that position for the past 22 years, talking about then versus now in some ways, how the organization helps women. And perhaps, Carla, this is a good time. You've talked about some of the services provided, but I'm sure most of us are not aware of the menu of services that RVAP has come to help people out with.
Right. Initially, we did, we would go with the victim. We would provide that in-person direct services advocacy. And then as time went on, it became a need for counseling, individual group counseling, for education with all kinds of people. And it would be education with starting with victim survivors because they had heard all of the stuff. They'd been raised to believe it was their fault. It was, to be able to understand in the context of what happened to them that it wasn't their fault. And I think one of the major differences in that changed things was prior to the early 70s, victims were seen as something internally wrong with them. They were sick or they were damaged goods or they were whatever. And it was is really more of a cure kind of Western medicine kind of model. And with the feminist movement came the idea that I think is really accurate, which is that victims are reacting normally to abnormal situations. And that was something that Judith Herman talks about in a later book. Mm-hmm. But that that was a real paradigm shift for saying that, that you know, they were not at fault. It was the perpetrators who had acted against them. And there was nothing wrong with the victim except that they had been victimized.
And a lot of learning, I assume, too, in the recovery, that a lot of their future depends on the type of help they get, how society reacts to them as a victim.
Absolutely. You know, research has shown that the more sensitive response, the more supportive response early on, once they report it to someone, really has a major impact on their healing and their progress in being able to recover. And this is from when they tell parents, the response of parents, friends, professionals. If they run into people who are supportive to them and who are kind, you know, as you would be to someone who was a victim of something else, anything else in, practically, that they were able to recover much more quickly. You know, and it's always been kind of an interesting, ironic thing that victims are victim witnesses. So they're witnesses to a crime, and we need them to be able to hold people who are hurting the community accountable, and yet we treat them horribly. Now, I'm not, you know, people talk about, well, you have to have due process and it's whatever. Of course you do. But you can do that without impugning victims' character and the like.
Carla Miller is a recently retired director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program. And I want to ask you, because you've mentioned perpetrators a couple of times, how have we advanced there in not only understanding the victims' needs, but the side of the perpetrators, a very important side to understand, mm-hmm. because isn't it the case that often perpetrators don't see them as themselves as committing a crime in many
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so much justification, so much denial on their part. So many thinking errors that go into those justifications. And, you know, the sex offender treatment programs are and field is very, very young. It began around 1984 in the prison systems.
Do you and your people, do you encourage your staff to get to know perpetrators? Do you somehow have a way to do that, to get that standpoint understood?
We don't. I haven't encouraged people to get to know them. Although, if someone is interested in learning more, I would try to facilitate that. But about them is critical, and so we both in our advocates and our staff spent a lot of time training about the psychology, the motivations, the types of perpetrators, and. I began working around 84. I was invited down by Dudley Allison, who was the new director then, and to come down and talk with them about victims, victim impact. And that's when I began, you know, I sat in on a group down there. That's when I began to really get to know the importance of being able to ask perpetrators questions that victims asked us. So,
for instance,
why did he choose me? Is there anything I could have done differently? You know, how did this happen? Is, you know, those kinds of questions. And, you know, was it my fault? So what was important was to teach our staff and advocates about perpetrators so that we would understand the context of the assault, so that we would be able to understand what was going on with the perpetrators and that the victim was reacting to, mm-hmm. and that had nothing to do with the victim, except perhaps they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, or that this perpetrator had a fantasy that this victim, you know, turns out she didn't want to have sex or whatever. And that was very important, because if you look at a trial, the focus is put on to the victim or people who support the victim or circumstances, anything to keep it away from the perpetrator. And the reason is because you can't defend those indefensible behaviors. And if you can get people looking at other things, then you know, it's kind of a red herring kind of situation where you can not focus on the deeds.
Carla Miller, when you look back over your time with the Rape Victim Advocacy Program, can you just list off briefly the successes you see, the milestones that you see in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were so many of them. There was the issue of cameras in the courtroom, the exclusion of rape victims when television came into the courtroom, the rape shield law, where they couldn't bring up the victim's past sexual history. The changing of the code was key, which is going from charging rape to degrees of sexual assault, first, second, and third. Also, they had assault with intent to commit sexual abuse, and that versus burglary. They used to charge burglary in these cases. So if you look back, you could have a serial rapist, which is what they all are, but you could have a serial rapist that you would never know that there was a sexual component to that crime.
Because it was charged as burglary.
Right, right. And in we already talked about the sex offender treatment program, kind of codifying or identifying victims' rights, a set of victims' rights. I think that there were many cases that moved these things along. Key cases here, we were in the spotlight in Iowa City on the Pierre Pierce case, the two professors who committed suicide. Also in the Satterfield-Everson case. And we learned from and there were other cases that we learned many things that needed to be done institutionally and attitudinally, if that's a word. We looked at Title IX, which I think people looked at as the sports, equality in sports. But it also covered safety for women on campus, leading to Title IX, or that was part of Title IX. Then there was the Clery Act to notify if there were dangerous people on campus and to keep track of things that happened. There were anti-violence grants that pulled people together from the president down and then all throughout the university. So all of those types of things, you know, the sex offender registry when it came along.
Can we say, after you list those, definitely that young women in Iowa are safer than they were three, four decades ago?
Yeah. I think that the thing that's always made the difference on how safe somebody is whether there's a sex offender around. But I think we're holding offenders more accountable than we ever have. I know that institutionally, people are better educated, more aware, policies are better. There's educational efforts that are more widespread. So, you know, I think we can say there's greater awareness, there's greater support for victims than ever. Many, many positive changes.
Carla Miller, what do you see or what would you hope would be your legacy after leaving the Rape Victim Advocacy Program?
I would hope that I would be known for speaking using a phrase that Al Gore used, inconvenient truths, talking about denial, and continuing to keep at things until people paid attention. I would hope I'd be known as someone, along with my colleagues, who are amazing, who would be voice for the victims, encouraging or demanding holding offenders accountable, and encouraging and educating others. And, you know, basically just knowing that minimally we were there for, you know, my colleagues and I were there when somebody called.
Finally, Carla, I want to ask about, first, congratulate you on a wonderful career with the Rape Victim Advocacy Program. Must be very satisfying to be able to look back on such success and the building of such a tremendous program for women and for all of us here in Iowa. What's next on your plate as you leave this post?
I'm looking forward to doing, focusing in on some of the things that I wasn't able to do because I had other responsibilities as director, things, expert witness work, having probably a small practice, working with victims. I don't want to stop doing that. That was always my passion. It's why I did the administrative work to begin with. And work-wise, those are some of the things. I want to do some writing and that kind of thing and reflecting on the years. I also realize that the career has taken a toll on the nature of the career has taken a toll on health and on being able to focus on a private life, you know, my family and friends. And so I want to spend more time now trying to get more balance in that area.
Okay. Well, we wish you well in all of those endeavors. And thank you for coming in the studio to talk with us, Carla Miller.
I appreciate you asking me.
Carla Miller, former director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program based in Iowa City. Coming up in just a moment after a short break, we'll hear from Jill June. June retired this week as president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland after 30 years. We'll ask her about recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings, as well as how laws and attitudes about reproductive rights have changed over the decades. That's when River to River continues from Iowa Public Radio News.